Parshas Chayesara begins with the discussion of the purchase by Avram of the Maras Machpelah, the field, the Ma'ara, from Ephron and the Bnei Ches. The Torah begins with about two dozen psukim describing the negotiations, the transaction, the details of the purchase of the plot, for including the cave of Machpelah, which was to be used as a burial plot for Avram's wife, Sarah. So a number of Rishonim, the Ralbag, and several of the Baalei Tosis, make a very interesting inference from the Psukim. They're actually, if you read what they say carefully, they're inferring the same idea from different aspects of a careful reading of the Psukim. The Ralbag, for example, says as follows. The Ralbag has a unique style in his commentary that, in addition to a running commentary of the Psukim, he often concludes by listing what he calls his toalias, lessons that you learn from the Psukim, lessons of sometimes halachic, sometimes philosophical, sometimes ethical, sometimes, and so on. In this case, when he finishes the story of Ephron and Avram and the purchase of the land, he says, you learn it's not appropriate for a neighbor to do anything, even in his own property, my property, it's not appropriate for someone to do anything which can cause injury, financial injury, or pain, suffering, nuisance to his neighbor, unless he gets their sign-off, unless they agree. That you can't just say, it's my property, I'm doing what I want. It doesn't work like that. You do have an obligation to avoid inconveniencing your neighbors. And he infers this from the psukim that one of the points that emerges in this psukim is that Avram seems to be negotiating both with Ephron personally as well as with the Bnei Ches. So, for example, it says he bowed to the Amar to Bnei Ches. Later it says, Asher Diber Bozne Bnei Ches. It says again, Lavram L'mikne L'ene Bnei Ches. It repeatedly says that the Bnei Ches were part of this transaction. It was part of the meeting, part of this arrangement involved the Bnei Ches. Why? I mean, if he's buying a private property from Ephron, why is anybody's business? Nobody's involved but them and their lawyers. You know, why does anybody else have to know? Why is it a community-wide event that Avram is buying property from the Bnei Ches? So the Ralbag says it's for this very reason, because Avram is going to build a cemetery. A cemetery is something that can inconvenience the neighbors, either the odors or for other reasons why a cemetery is not something you might want as your next door to you. So in addition to buying the private title to the land from Ephron, he had to secure the agreement, the consent of the community to build a cemetery. And the Ralbag notes, Ralbag refers to the fact that above Mastra there's an entire parak, and several prakim really, that deal with these questions, the laws that regulate the conduct of neighbors, that require the neighbors take into account each other's convenience when doing things in their own property. Now again, we were discussing earlier before we began whether Ralbag means that the Bnei Ches were Talmidei Chachamim and they were familiar with Shas, or he just means that there's an ethical idea, that there's a fundamental notion of Yosher, of the correct way for human society to develop, is that people should take into account the neighbors. Private property is not an absolute right. You can't do things in your property. It's reflected in the Talmud by specific halachas, but even in the time of Ephron, Avram at least wanted to conduct himself according to with a sense of integrity, with a sense of consideration for his neighbors, which is later codified in halacha. However it is, that's what the Ralbag is going on here. Ephron had to secure the cooperation of the Bnei Ches before he could build a cemetery. The Chizkuni, one of the Tosafos commentaries on the Torah, says something very similar. He points out that earlier it says, "Vayakum Avram vayishtachu l'amaretz l'bnei ches." Earlier it says Avram rose and he bowed to the Am Haaretz, to the general public. Later it says Avram bowed again when the deal was over. It says. It says again that he bowed to. It says that he bowed to Ephron. So it says, earlier it says, Vayishtach Avram Lufnei Am Haaretz. Earlier it says, Vayishtachu Le'am Haaretz. Later it says, Lufnei Am Haaretz. He says, once he bowed to the public, he needed their permission. And once he bowed to Ephron, he says, when he got up, he says, when he had to turn around to bow to the people who were in the seats behind him, he had to stand up and turn in their direction and bow. He bowed to Ephron. Ephron was right across the table. He just was where he was. He bowed to Ephron. But there were two separate obeisances there. There were two separate bowings going on. One was to Ephron and one was to the Vayishtach Avram at Lufnam Aretz, was to Ephron in the presence of Am Aretz. Earlier was to the Am Aretz themselves, and again, because there were two things going on. He had to secure Ephron's consent to transfer the title, and he had to deal with the rest of the city, because they had to get to secure their permission before he could build a cemetery. Hadar Zakenim, that's another one of the commentaries of the Balei Tosfos. He says, he phrases it kind of as we would do, not so much that you get a actual plebiscite, a referendum in the whole city. He says you would have to get permission from what he calls the Gedolei Ha'er. We would call that the political leadership, the zoning board, or the legislature, or whatever it is, that the Gedolei Ha'er, the leaders of the city, you have to get permission from them. And again, that's why first it says... That he makes yet another inference. It says the word Vayakam, we just talked about Vayakam, Avram got up to bow. When it refers to the transaction of the field itself, the transfer of the field from Ephron and the Bnei Chais to Avram, it says Vayakam about the Sada twice. First it says Vayakam stay Ephron, the field arose literally, was transferred over to Avram, and a couple of psukim later, it says again, Vayakam the field, Vayakam Asad, Amar Shabo, Avram. It says again, the field, the two terms both denoting transfer, as if the field was somehow transferred twice. So he says again, because the halacha is, you have to A, get a transfer of the actual title from the holder of the title, the private owner of the property, and B, you have to secure a right from the government that for you to be able to do certain things which would otherwise be considered nuisances, possibly, and objectionable by the neighbors. You have to get permission from the government to zone it for that, to get a variance, whatever you want to call it, to get permission to do what you want to do to the field. We have yet another comment of the Balei Tosfos, that again, the Riva, it says Vayakam Vayakam, it says the language of Kima, of arising, of transferring twice. So again, one was the private title, and one was from the government, because again, you're not allowed to build things like cemeteries without permission from the government, who are in essence the representatives of the public. So this basic idea, the Ralbag and a number of the Balei Tosfos, basic idea that Avram, in addition to buying the title, was also securing the rights to build a cemetery. Cemetery is actually one of the things listed in the Talmud. When the Talmud in Bava Basra, the second parak, lists the various types of usages of a property that are either totally prohibited or more generally, you have to have a certain setback. You have to have a certain, in the case of the cemetery, the halacha actually is you have to have a certain setback depending on what direction the wind is going, downwind, upwind, but you have to have a certain distance that the cemetery has to be. It's not actually all that far. 100 feet is probably enough, 50 amos, but in general, these halacha cemeteries actually listed on Chazal's list of one of the things that you need permission to do from the neighbors. So I want to discuss for the rest of our time a few specific examples of poskim that have dealt with things, nuisances that you're not allowed to do, and discuss how we'll look at some of the actual halachas from the Talmud and how they get applied in real-world situations. The actual Talmudic discussion, this is called Nizkei Shcheinim, the torts, the damages of neighbors. And many of the specific examples are not really that relevant to us. They involve certain types of usages, different types of chemicals or agricultural processes, which are we don't do today, or if we do them, they're not typically done in residential areas. But the underlying principles, many of them are relevant, and we'll kind of go through a few examples to discuss, to see how these halachas are applied to contemporary or modern situations. Smoking. So, just go through a little bit of the history of the halachas of smoking. Smoking as in cigarette smoking, pipe smoking, cigar smoking. So, smoking and nicotine enters the halachic literature about 300 years ago. We first have tshuvas about this in the 1700s. The question there was not nuisance, was not a question of the neighbors objecting. The question there was, there were two main questions that were discussed in the early literature on smoking. One of them is Yontif, they were allowed to smoke on Yom Tovim. The other issue was fast days, they were allowed to smoke on Tisha B'Av, Shabbat Tamas. Obviously, Yom Kippur is not an issue because smoking involves making a fire, which is prohibited on Shabbos and Yom Tov and Yom Kippur. But the question was, smoking on Yom Tov, where a fire is permitted for Tzara Chochel Nefet, permitted for Yom Tov uses, the question is, are you allowed to smoke on Yom Tov? So again, the literature begins around the 18th century. where I guess smoking was becoming more popular in Europe. And there's a tremendous amount of dispute on both these questions. Briefly, on Yom Tov, the question was, even though we generally permit malacha, which is for the need of Yom Tov, you can light a fire for cooking, you can light a fire for any Yom Tov need, but there are certain kinds of needs which are not considered important enough, and the technical definition is complicated. It has to do with shav elachal nefesh. It has to be a use which is considered widespread or universal. But back then, smoking was pretty common. Still was up until the mid-20th century. Still is to some extent. But so the postman debated whether smoking was considered a mainstream and universal enough practice to be considered shav elachal nefesh. We're not going to get into the debate much on that point. Even today, many people still do smoke on Yom Tov. I don't know if there's a dominant practice, but there definitely are people today. As we'll note later, Moshe Feinstein actually has a relatively, he wrote actually, I think, at least four different tshuvas dealing with different aspects of smoking. This is, I think, the last one I'm aware of. In 1984, he still argued that smoking was still a relatively ubiquitous, universal practice and still was mutter on Yom Tov.
In the case of Avraham, we're dealing with a problem of public damage or public good. In this case, it's a halachic issue.
I'll explain what I mean. I'm going to be talking about secondhand smoke and the inconvenience to the neighbors.
Okay.
So we'll get to that. I'm first going to discuss the basic background of smoking, and we'll turn to the neighborly part soon. So, as a matter of fact, the early tshuvas in the 1700s, where they discussed why we permitted to smoke on Yom Tov, they said smoking is good for you. It's good for the digestion, it's good for the nerves, whatever it is. They actually felt it was actually good. Today, it is universally accepted smoking is really, really bad for you. It kills you, it causes all kinds of other diseases. So today, obviously, we have a different view on things. The other issue discussed for the next few hundred years was smoking on fast days. We know we don't eat on fast days, but other things which are enjoyable or pleasurable, we don't necessarily forbid. Tisha B'Av has more restrictions, but even then it has five specific restrictions. So the question arose, and is smoking considered a form of eating or drinking? Is it prohibitive for some other reason? So there was a great debate about that. I don't know what the prevailing custom is. I just have to mention one thing, a digression, but one of the most amazing things I've seen in the halakhic literature. One of the poskim who was most strict, who was most vehemently opposed to smoking on Tisha B'Av, was Rav Chaim ben Venisti, the Knesset Gedolah, a leading Sephardic authority of the 18th century. He was vehemently opposed to smoking. He had very, very strong language how it was awesome. Fine. For technical reasons. So, 200 years later, in the 19th century, there's a tshuva of Rav Yosef Zachariah Stern. Rav Yosef Zachariah Stern was an archetypal Litvish posik, brilliant erudite scholar, but also very, very well-read, a very intriguing thinker. So he's discussing, in general, doing a brief survey of the literature on smoking, and he says, many achronim quote the Knesset Gedolah, quote Rav Chaim ben Venisti, as being so vehemently opposed to smoking. You should know, he says, you should take that with a grain of salt. Don't take that at face value. Why? And he makes one of the most fascinating halakhic arguments I've ever seen. He says, Rav Chaim ben Venisti lived in the time of Shabtai Tzvi. Rav Chaim ben Venisti was initially, as many Gedolim, were a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. Many of even the great rabbis of the time were, for a while, seduced by his persuasiveness. And he actually, I think, attained the position, a coveted rabbinic position, based on the fact that his rival for the position was an opponent of Shabtai Tzvi, and Shabtai Tzvi's followers had the upper hand. I think it was Constantinople or Smyrna. And he was favored by the Shabtai Tzvi followers because he was a supporter of Shabtai Tzvi at that time. Subsequently, when the Shabtai Tzvi thing exploded, when he apostatized and died, so he, like most sane people of the time, realized that it had been a terrible mistake. And he then became he deeply regretted that he had been misled by a false messiah. And he became a vehement opponent of Shabtai Tzvi. Now, what does this have to do with smoking on fast days? So Rav Stern says, we know that Shabtai Tzvi, one of the things that he started to transgress, one of the things he did, the antinomian things he did to reject the halacha, was that he argued the gula is coming very soon, the redemption, and therefore the halacha of Avelus, the fast days, we can start, they start to fall by the wayside. So some of his famous controversial things involve not keeping the fast days. So says Rav Stern, we know there is no what's the language about, there's no one who's as angry and as vehement against the object of his former belief than someone who realizes he's been misled. The love, the admiration turns to fury. He said, "Sir Chaim ben Venisti, who had made the mistake of being a follower of Shabtai Tzvi, became a fanatical opponent of Shabtai Tzvi, and anything that smacked of any leniency on a fast day, he came down like a ton of bricks against." When he was so vehemently opposed to smoking, you have to take it in context. It was written in that time where there had been disillusioned followers of Shabtai Tzvi, and they were therefore fanatically opposed to anything to do with kulos, leniencies of fast days. But in any event, that's the literature on smoking, on yontif, on fast days. Beginning in the 20th century, Poskim began to realize that smoking was, as we said, really, really dangerous. The earliest tshuvas come up in the 60s. I don't know the exact history of what the science was like, but pretty much the Poskim follow the awareness of the science as the decades go on, from the 60s to the 70s to the 80s to the 21st century. You can kind of watch the consensus of halachic opinion move from a kind of grudging acceptance to a much stronger, uncompromising attitude of it being prohibited because it is very dangerous. Halacha requires that a person not deliberately endanger himself. We don't have this attitude that you fundamentally control your body. The Torah tells you, "V'nishmartem od l'nafshoseichem," a Jew has the obligation to take care of himself, to not put himself in more risk than necessary. And therefore, as the decades roll on, we find more and more of a consensus in the poskim that smoking is prohibited. I meant even during the week. I'm moving now from yontif to during the week. We find that they begin to discuss the general question of whether smoking is permitted at all. And as you're saying, the poskim more and more begin to take the position that smoking is absolutely prohibited. The RCA came out with a statement a decade or two ago, kind of summarizing the rabbinic opinion, arguing that smoking was flat out prohibited. Leading poskim have concluded that it's prohibited, and they have a very strong view. Certainly, their rabbanim are Herschel Schechter, or Vaiwillig, but even many of the kind of more traditional, more European poskim, to some extent, you find what you would expect to find, the kind of ideological divide. The poskim are more Western, more modern, more American, are probably quicker to say it's prohibited because they're less encumbered by the baggage of the fact that many great rabbis smoked. They're quicker to recognize modern science and modern health conclusions. But even many of the much more reactionary, more traditional, so to speak, poskim have come to realize that smoking is a lethal habit and have used very strong language against it. My favorite is the Debrecen Rav, Moshe Stern. He was as reactionary as they come. He was a leading Hungarian posek in Baropark in the last half of the 20th century. He nevertheless concluded that smoking was usur because it kills you and there's no justification for it. He, being very traditional, was forced to grapple with the fact that in previous generations, even pretty recently, says great rabbis were still smoking. How could they do that if it's so dangerous? So we would just say they didn't know. They were human beings. They back then, they thought it was good for you to smoke. So nothing wrong with the fact that rabbis didn't know modern scientific conclusions. But he's not willing to say that. So he has a bunch of theories for why it's more of a problem today than it used to be. One of them, a particularly interesting theory, he says, is that, sounds like an environmentalist here, he says that used to be the bucolic villages in Europe were free of pollution, fresh air, person's lungs were strong, they were hardy, they were tough. A little smoke wasn't so bad for you. Just today, the cities are fighting a losing battle against pollution all day long. You breathe in garbage, you breathe in, the government's recognizing you're breathing in all kinds of foul junk all day. It eats away at your lungs are in bad shape to begin with, he says. So for us, our lungs are in such bad shape, the smoke will be, whether that's true that our lungs are in better shape than they were in villages in Europe, I don't know. But the point is, even people like the Debrecen, or even people who are very traditional, very reactionary, nevertheless concluded that smoking is lethal and smoking kills you and you should not be doing it. Actually, in the last couple of years, two noted Sephardic poskim in Eretz Yisrael made waves by coming out with statements that someone who smokes should not be given the position of an aide, a witness at a chasna, because he's an avarian, he's a sinner, he's doing an avera, and he's pasul aedus. That's already a strong statement, but the point is, that just goes to show how far the pendulum has swung, that more and more poskim are accepting that today smoking is not acceptable. But
We started out with doing something on your property that's going to affect the community. Now we're talking about if you smoke by yourself.
That's what I'm going to get to now. We're going to clarify that now. So most of this literature I've been quoting is in general, whether an individual in the privacy of his own home is allowed to smoke. Halacha requires that you keep yourself safe, and they discuss yes or no. But there is a subset of the literature, which is what you were both raising. There is a subset of the literature which just discusses the question. Let's say we don't assume there's a prohibition for you to smoke. Let's say we have some of the heterim involved that it's not us here to smoke. But can someone else object? If you're smoking in a public place, can a Beis Medrash or a restaurant, a concert hall, something, can your neighbors object? Or coworkers in an office? So the classic Niske Shechenim deals with literally neighbors. Usually in a regular two homeowners who live next door, usually an individual smoking a cigarette is not going to cause, the smoke will kind of be diluted before it gets outdoors to his neighbor. On the other hand, this is a very common question in apartment buildings. You can have condos or apartment buildings where, because of the ventilation, my wife is very disturbed by this sometimes, where if neighbors smoke, the smoke goes through the vents and comes down in your apartment. And it's very annoying. Some people really can't stand the smell, and B, it can be dangerous. So, and the truth is, both these points are discussed by the poskim. When people object to secondhand smoke, there are really two objections. Some people object they just really don't like it; the smell really bothers them. Some people just really can't stand cigarette smoke. The other objection is that it's dangerous. And here again, the science is kind of taking a little longer to develop than the science on active smoking, but secondhand smoke, passive smoke, environmental smoke, whatever you want to call it, the science has pretty much developed over the decade or two behind, but by now it's pretty much universal that secondhand smoke is pretty deadly too. There's what they call side stream smoke, the smoke that comes off the end of the cigarette. There's what they call mainstream smoke, the smoke that gets inhaled and exhaled. But both those things contain all kinds of carcinogens. Pretty much a who's who of all the major health organizations, American Cancer Society, the Mayo, the WHO, one after the Surgeon General, one after another, all the national and international organizations have all concluded, based on studies and meta-studies, that secondhand smoke also is really dangerous. The numbers I've seen thrown around are, in the United States, they've argued that secondhand smoke causes something like 7,000 or so annual deaths from lung cancer, and some 30,000-40,000 deaths a year from circulatory disease, heart diseases, plus all kinds of problems with asthma and problems with children. Secondhand smoke is pretty bad for you also. A lot of the studies deal with things like spouses or coworkers. So we're not talking about one cigarette, but living in close proximity to a smoker for a long period of time is really bad for you too, apparently. So the question becomes, again, the post can grapple with this question. In a public space, that was the classic version of the question. In a public space, can a neighbor object? Can someone else object to your smoking? So some of the first discussion we have of this is about 1981. We have a pair of tshuvas, one by Rav Moshe Feinstein and one by Rav Yosef Shalom Eliashiv, of blessed memory, both of them. They actually debate this point. They come down on opposite sides of the issue. Rabbi Feinstein, throughout his life, he never came out to actually forbid smoking for an individual. He has, as I mentioned earlier, he has at least four published tshuvas on smoking. In all of them, he tolerates smoking for an individual. He invokes the doctrine of Shomer Psoim Hashem, that things which are dangerous but are widespread and are considered normal by large swaths of society are mutter, even if there's some danger. Some people say he would have changed his mind as the evidence continued to mount. Some people say this was still in the 80s, by the time the 90s and the 21st century came around. He would have retracted. Some of his closest students ruled very strongly against it. But the fact is, in his published literature, he was never willing to forbid smoking, even on Yontif. In 1984, he still wrote that smoking is still common enough, even on Yontif, it's mutter, certainly during the week.
Is he himself a smoker?
Not that I know of, but I'm not certain. So, in 1981, though, he was asked about smoking in a Beis Medrash or a shul, and he basically forbids it. He argues that, as we said earlier, the basic halacha of Niske Shechenim, Parshas Chayesara, you're not allowed to do anything, even in your property, which causes damage or injury to a neighbor. Rav Moshe makes both these points, that A, it is dangerous, and B, that there is a question of tzar. He says that even because of tzar, there's a reason to object. Even if there's no chashash shakana and no chashash choli, no question of illness or danger, it's just difficult, they suffer from it, it's usher. That's basically Moshe's position. He considers this a classic question of Niske Shainim. You're doing something in a public space which is affecting the neighbors. In your own house, it would be Oster if the wind would blow it, or like in an apartment, certainly he would say it's Oster because the wind blows it over into your neighbor's space. He's certainly in a public space, you're not allowed to do it. He makes an interesting point. He says, even if one individual smoker wouldn't cause such a problem, he says, insofar as it becomes a non-smoke-free zone, people smoke all day, and the aggregate, the smoke is a problem, then that is considered a hezek. They get injured, they get... It's bad for health, it's annoying, he says. Bittel Torah, he says, it's not relevant. He says, Bittel Torah goes both ways. The non-smokers say that the smoke is disturbing our Torah. The smokers say, if we can't smoke, it's disturbing our Torah. So that's a wash, but in any event, he says, it doesn't matter. You can't do things that bother and hurt other people. Bittel Torah is not the issue here. The issue is a Jew has no right to do things which actively inconvenience and harm his neighbors, and therefore smoking in a public place is awesome.
People like it. I mean, if there's people don't have a problem.
If nobody minds, then it'll be fine, right?
We'll be fine.
According to Moshe, smoking is not dangerous enough. He wasn't willing to prohibit it for you yourself. And it follows, if everyone in the public space agrees that it's okay, then it wouldn't be a problem, right?
If you ask people, will you mind?
Yeah, then it will be fine. According to Moshe, will be fine, yes. Rabbi Yashiv argued. Rabbi Yashiv was flat out opposed to this. Rabbi Yashiv said, even though all the people who allow smoking, even back in the 80s, they said it's not a good idea. It's, you know, why do it? It's a habit. You become addicted to something that you don't need. And there is some element of danger, even if it's a hatchet for it. Nobody thinks it's a good idea. Rabbi Yashiv also doesn't think it's a good idea to smoke. He was opposed to it. But he said, al pi din mamash, you can't ask her. He does say in the end of the tshuva, even if it's mutter, he says, a person who's a mensch, a person who has derech eretz and has, you know, some sensitivity to his neighbor should really try not to, he says, because Chazal were very concerned that you shouldn't do things that inconvenience neighbors. So certainly in terms of mussar, in terms of menschlichkeit, you really should try not to. He says, however, mi'ikar adin, applying the strict laws of Niske Shcheinim, Rav Yashiv says, you cannot prohibit it. His basic argument is that since there is a heter for the smoker himself, the heter is Shomer Psoim Hashem. This is a halachic argument that the parameters are tricky, but the base of the halachic argument we alluded to earlier, something which is widespread, and even if there is some element of objective danger, the danger is not that high perhaps, and it's a widespread practice, and considered by society at large to be normal. The devil's in the details. You know, what later posts can reject this and say, it's lethal, it, you know, kills tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, and there's no Shomer Psoim Hashem on that. But Rav Yashiv felt, at least in 1981, he felt that the danger was constrained enough and it was a widespread enough practice that it is mutter. So he says, and not only that, he says, some people might argue it's mutter for you, but you can't do it at someone else's expense if it's dangerous. Rav Yashiv says, no, once it's mutter, he says, you can do it even at the expense of other people. Mi'ikar adin, he says, that's the way it works. It brings rias to this. And that as long as it's something which halacha doesn't recognize as being so dangerous to be absolutely prohibited, it is mutter to do. It's considered it's a societally sanctioned practice. It's mutter to do even though the neighbors don't appreciate it. Again, Musser and Menschlichkeit should say you really should try not to. But according to the strict halacha, Rav Yashiv says it is not prohibited. Now, there's an interesting discussion of this by a lesser known rabbi, Rabbi Baumel. He points out something that was bothering me for many years. That this discussion of Moshe or Yashiv makes sense if we're dealing with smoking, let's say, in your own house, and it's affecting my neighbors. My neighbor says, well, the smoke is getting into my house, and I don't like it. And you say, well, I'm smoking in my house. Fine, so you can apply the classic paradigms of Niske Shcheinim. When it comes to a public place, like let's say like a shul or a restaurant even, or a bar or a movie theater, I would have argued a very different paradigm. I would have argued that shul we can debate, but let's say a restaurant or a movie theater. It's private property. It belongs to the business owner. The business owner should have the right to set the rules, whatever he wants. Now, again, I'm not discussing legislation. Halacha might very well require you to follow whatever the government legislates. I'm not talking about the question of not disobeying the law. Let's say there's no law, but before they passed laws. So I would have said we shouldn't apply the rule of Niske Shcheinim at all. We should simply say let the property owner decide what he wants the rules to be. If I'm owning a restaurant, if I want to allow smoking, let me allow smoking. You don't like it, so you're free to find a different restaurant or eat at home. If I, the restaurant owner, say I don't want smoking, then the smoker can say, I don't care if it's dangerous or not, I don't want smoking, so you find a different restaurant. It seems to me that at least in these quasi-public places, which are really still private property, It should be up to the property owner to set the rules. The same way if I have a private house and I want to have a private party and I want to say there will be smoking at the party, if you don't like that, don't go to the party. If I want to say there won't be smoking, if you want to smoke, you don't go to the party. So I would have said it's up to the private owner. Even when it comes to a shul or a quasi-public place, I would have said the shuls are governed by whoever they're governed, by boards, by presidents, by officers, by committees. I would have said the same way the shul makes 100 other decisions, what kind of food can come in, and what kind of chairs can come in, and what kind of standards, and what the policy is for this or that. I would have said it should really be up to the shul to set the policy. If the shul wants to have the shul to be a smoking venue, then let the non-smokers find a different shul, or vice versa. Nevertheless, Moshe and Eliashiv both seem to treat at least shuls, and not discussing restaurants and movie theaters, but at least shuls that they want to discuss as, they want to look at as public places, in which case we apply the rules, the classic rules in this case, that if there's injury or damage, if it's significant, you have to stop, and if there's no damage, then it's okay, and they just disagree about whether the damage isn't, whether the danger or the inconvenience is enough to warrant a prohibition on the smoker to avoid inconveniencing and harming the non-smoker. Rabbi Baumol, the author of this other article, he wants to say what I said. No, that we look at he doesn't want to look at it as private property. He wants to look at it as what he calls shutvas, as jointly held property. He comes to an even more strict conclusion. He argues that when property is jointly held, none of the owners is allowed to do anything which inconveniences the other owners, even if it's not mamash hazik. That since it's joint property, any of us has a veto power on anybody else doing something which we don't like. Since smoking is something that we don't like, even if it's not, strictly speaking, something that would be usur in the case of Chazal, that means I can do it on my own property. But in jointly held property, every one of the property owners has a veto, and including shul property, which he wants to look at as a publicly held property, he wants to argue that the halakha would be that every stakeholder, every member of the public is considered a shareholder, or considered a partner, a part owner, has the right to object to anybody else smoking in the public area. And there are others who take the position that it's usur also. Rav Osner of the Shevet Halevi, also a very Haredi, very traditional posik, nevertheless argues that smoking is out of the question. It's absolutely usur, he says, in a public place. Chalila la'ashin mekamos diburim, heaven forfend that somebody should smoke in a public place, because even the reach, even the secondhand smoke, the side stream smoke, whatever, is mazik gomer. Kashen esfar b'chakira. Science shows that secondhand smoke is really dangerous, really, really harmful, and therefore takes for granted, goes without saying, he says, I don't think the tshuva has a date, but this is one of the more recent tshuvas, he says, it goes without saying that smoking in a public place is awesome. We'll discuss one other modern question that comes up. That is, we think of this as a zoning question, opening an office, specifically opening a medical office, a clinic, or a doctor's office in a residential area. So the Talmudic discussion does talk about opening different kinds of professional establishments. It discusses different kinds of vendors or shops or offices of people who offer goods and services to the public. And Chazal worried either about the noise, if you're dealing with a blacksmith, you're worried about making noise. They were also worried about the traffic. They were worried about what we call kol nechnasin v'yotzin, the noise of all the traffic, the clients, the customers, or the inconvenience of having people running around. It's crowded, it takes away the space, takes away the less room to move around. So the Gemara discusses these objections, and the Gemara says, indeed, these are problems. You're not allowed to open these kind of professional establishments when there are other residential neighbors who might object. So what about a doctor's office? Why should a doctor's office be any different? So the Gemara makes an exception. The Gemara says that for a yeshiva, for a school in which children are taught Torah, there is a heter because it's such an important mitzvah that they suspended the normal right to object, they suspended because of the need to have yeshivas. Now there are opinions that say this is limited to yeshivas, for which was a very special need, but the halacha follows the more general view that it says not just the mitzvah of teaching Torah, any mitzvah in general is a... There's a dispensation. If you have any mitzvah purpose, you're allowed to open in spite of the neighbor's objections. So it would seem, certainly, that what about a doctor? What about a clinic, a medical clinic? Sounds like a mitzvah. Certainly, you would think it would be a mitzvah. So it should be mutter. So the problem is that it says in Shulchan Aruch and some of the Rishonim that a rofe, a physician, is osur. You're not allowed to open a rofe, an uman, certain types of professions, including rofe, are osur. So the Acharonim will ask, why? Why should it be usur? Isn't healing people a mitzvah? So there are some who try to argue that the real mitzvah of the physician, even though it's explicitly he's doing a mitzvah, the mitzvah is only when he heals life-threatening diseases, healing more minor ailments. Is that a mitzvah? I don't think that's the consensus at all. This author brings opinions both ways. I'm pretty sure the consensus view is that the practice of medicine in general, even for non-life-threatening ailments, is a mitzvah. So that's what all the Achronim seem to assume. So why should it be prohibited to open a medical clinic, to open a doctor's office? What happened to the dispensation of mitzvah? So we have a number of different approaches in the Achronim, all of which have implications for the modern question of opening a modern doctor's office in a residential area. So the Taz argues that the heter of mitzvah is only for something which inherently requires a public office, which will involve a lot of commotion, a lot of traffic, since there's no other way to do it. You can't have a school before they had modern technology and distance learning and all these newfangled educational methodologies. In the olden days, you couldn't have a school without some central place to gather students. And therefore, there was no way to do it without, and they didn't have, I guess, clearly defined commercial zones or residential zones. There was no way to effectively have a school without having a public gathering of students, so they have to give a heter. However, says the Taz, anything which could be done in a less public, less tumultuous way should be done that way, and there's no heter of having a public gathering. Therefore, he says, doctors can make house calls. They don't have to have a central office for everyone to come visit in their office annoying the neighbors. They can go take their little black bag and visit the patients, and therefore there's no heter to have a central doctor's office. Same thing in Mohel. Someone who's doing bris milah also the some post can say is austere to have a central office, and the reason is because it's easy. After we do it today, certainly the mohel comes to the parents, he doesn't really have a central office where people are coming in and out all day, so mamela it is austere to do it that way. He has to go to the patients and they shouldn't come to him. Many acharonim push back against the Taz. They say certainly today and even in the time of Chazal, it's not realistic for the doctor to have no office and make house calls. First of all, it would take him twice as much time, and he could see either fewer patients or won't be able to do it as cost effectively. Especially today, we need equipment. Someone talks about having a dental
hospitals
for sure, right? And Revozner talked even about a dentist, because he can't carry around his drill and his chair and his things. Certainly, Adrian is saying hospitals. You need equipment. You need MRI machines. You need hospital beds. You need the whole infrastructure. You need all the nurses. It's not realistic. Certainly today, much of, you know, there are some practices who still theoretically can and do make house calls, but by and large, in many cases, it'll be either impossible or prohibitively expensive or impractical to do it. And some folks can say, on the contrary, but in the olden days, it would have been hard. Before they had cell phones and websites, how's the doctor going to know who's sick? I mean, he can't go around knocking on doors, are you sick? Are you sick? They have to come to him and tell him when they're sick. So practically, they say, even if the Taz's argument makes sense, they say, practically speaking, it's difficult to argue that a doctor can really operate without an office, and therefore, they don't accept the distinction of the Taz. So there are a number of other approaches. There are a number of other approaches to this. One svara, said by the Avner Nezer and Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, is a very interesting svara, and it's a fairly compelling one, you can argue, although it's debatable, but it makes a lot of sense, is that when Chazal gave you a heter for mitzvah, they were talking about mitzvahs where people have no inherent real interest in them. They do them because they're mitzvahs. If they wouldn't be mitzvahs, they wouldn't do them. So, for example, teaching Torah, a person does it because he knows it's God's will that his children learn Torah. But it's a mitzvah. That's why he's doing it. Now, if it became difficult to have schools, yeshivas, because the neighbors would have the right to object, so chas v'shalom, school might not open, might not be a school. He said, when it comes to mitzvahs that everyone does for his own ulterior motives, you go to a doctor, maybe it's a mitzvah, that's not why you go. People go because they want to be healthy. They want it to stop hurting. They want to live. They want to stay healthy. So the halakha doesn't have to give you any special dispensations. You'll find a way to have a doctor. The neighbors will object. You'll negotiate with them. You'll deal with them. You'll find a space where they don't object. He says the Torah doesn't have to cut you any slack because there's enough native demand for it that it'll get done anyway. So a yeshiva, unfortunately, if we give the neighbors too much power to object, the plan might collapse. Doctors, you know, they'll find a way to have offices. People, there's enough demand for it that there'll be a doctor's office. So these Achronim argue any mitzvah which, even without the mitzvah, there'd be enough demand to do it, there was no need for halacha to make exemptions because there was no need of the plan not really working out. They can argue that some neighborhoods are underserved by doctors, some poorer neighborhoods, maybe there's a difference. But in general, they argue that doctors are something which will get done no matter what. So therefore, there was no need to make any exceptions to the halacha. Avinezer was talking about, not actually doctors, he was talking primarily about some kind of slaughterhouse, an abattoir. And it was, the neighbors really didn't like it. It was smelly and noisy and whatever. So he's discussing the fact that you need a shlachtos to have kosher meat. So maybe it's a mitzvah, he says. He discusses it's not really a mitzvah. You don't have to eat meat. You can be a vegetarian. If you eat meat, you have to check. Is that enough of a mitzvah or not? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But one of the points he makes is that even if it's a mitzvah, he wants to argue that observant people are not going to stop eating meat because it's hard to build a... They're not going to eat treif meat because it's hard to build a slaughterhouse. Either they'll do without or they'll make sure they have one. So again, it's telling people need themselves. There's no worry that the plan will just fall through. People need meat. They're not going to eat treif meat, so there's no need to make any exception. If, however, there are some people who are not so observant, and if we don't make an easy, accessible slaughterhouse, they're going to eat treif meat, that might be a good argument to allow it, because the mitzvah need of causing people not to eat treif meat is important enough. That might actually be a good enough reason to allow for the building of a public slaughterhouse. Some poskim argue, the Aruch HaShulchan says, that when the early poskim said that a doctor's office is not allowed, they didn't mean an office, they meant a medical school. When it says rofe uman, they say it meant someone who teaches refuah. Even though that you think there might also be a mitzvah, because if doctors don't learn medicine, they won't be able to practice medicine. Nevertheless, he says that's, I guess, indirect. It's less of an immediate mitzvah. So a medical school, a place where people learn medicine, that's something which is not allowed. But an actual clinic would be permitted, apparently, according to the Aruch HaShulchan. And contemporary posts can actually go back and forth on the basic question of whether a medical clinic is okay. Some poskim, like the Shevet Halevi and others, say yes, it's a mitzvah. And even if in the Taz's time it wasn't so necessary, you can make house calls. Today it's certainly not an option in general. So some argue it's a classic mitzvah, it should be mutter, there's no question, we should have to allow it. Other poskim said no. Other poskim said, you know, it's really noisy, it's really inconvenient for the neighbors. And they argued that it should not be permitted, that there should be some other way of getting a doctor, but that you shouldn't be allowed to necessarily just build a busy, noisy medical office in a residential neighborhood. That's just a bridge too far. I saw in the Tshuva of Yehuda Herzl Henkin, he talks about a question of having something like a... He's talking about having a school. When Chazal talked about the heter for schools, they talked about teaching Torah to Tinoko Shel Beis Rabba and teaching Torah to Jewish kids. That's the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Later, poskim ask questions, what about girls' schools, which is not the classic mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Obviously, it's crucially important for chinuch, but it's a different kind of mitzvah. What about things like playgroups or daycare facilities? So if Yehuda Herzl Henkin wants to say that on the one hand, you can argue that a playgroup, a childcare facility, is not strictly a mitzvah. It's convenient for the parents, but it's not actually a mitzvah in the classic sense. On the other hand, he says... That's true. He says if the kids really could play in the street and you just want a more structured environment, it's more convenient, maybe it's not a mitzvah. He says today we can't play in the street. It's too dangerous. There are cars. You can't just let the kids run around like little urchins in the streets outside. Even in the park, he says, the kids are too young. It's not safe. He says you need people to take care of them. He says they need balls. He says he wants to argue that today... That since this kind of need of an athletic facility or a place for kids to play in a safe and organized fashion is something that people need, even I think independent of the question of mitzvah, it's something which is considered an essential part of life, and therefore it's the neighbors, he wants to argue, cannot object because it's not a luxury. It's not something which is optional. You can say, okay, don't have a daycare. The kids can just run around in the streets. That's not an option. You need that, and therefore halacha would actually allow that. And this in general is a kind of fundamental rule established by the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish says that all the technical halachas of Niske Sheinim, the laws of neighbors, all revolve, he says, you can't derive everything from first principles. You can't really say, it's not like regular my ox scores your ox, we can have a few basic rules and derive everything from that. He says neighbors, their respective uses of the property has to be regulated by Chazal in such a way that general happiness is maximized. We have to allow things and forbid things in such ways that it makes the most sense for society to live in a harmonious and balanced way. So Chazon Ish says anything which is considered, even when Chazal gave the right to people to object to certain particularly noisy activities, that's only if those noisy activities are particular jobs that he can do something else, or he can find a job site somewhere else. But something which is part of basic living, the Chazon Ish's example is kids are making noise at night. The neighbors don't want kids making noise at night. They say, you know, I don't know what they want you to do. Sell your kids and put them up for adoption. And I'm not sure what the alternative is, but the neighbors are saying, I'm sorry, I can't sleep. Your kids are crying at 3 in the morning. Chazon Ish says, what are you going to do? The kids are kids. You can't, that's part of living a normal life. You can't demand that your neighbors vacate their apartment because their kids are too noisy. Now, again, there might be limits. If the parents have a particular shita of chinuch that the kids are allowed to cry between 3 and 7 in the morning, maybe the Chazon Ish would feel differently. But in general, the Chazon Ish says things which are considered part of the normal and generally accepted manners of normal civilized life are mutter. The things that Chazal gave you the right to object to were things that were considered unusual or abnormal or specialty things. There, Chazal said, neighbors don't like it, so they say, find something else to do. Don't do this job, do a different job. Don't take up this hobby, take up a different hobby. If you want to do this, go find an office somewhere where the neighbors don't mind. But things which are considered part and parcel of the normal way of social life, those things are mutter and the neighbors can't object.